You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Caden. Efi Akine coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to ACT MP Karen Chaw about their new contractor policy, allegations of inappropriate behaviour towards children in Oranga Tamariki Care, and ACT's opposition to ethnicity being one of the factors for surgical waitlists. I also spoke to Etu Union spokesperson Annie Newman about ACT's proposal to ban contractors from challenging their employment status, and lecturer in theatre Dr. James Wenley and senior lecturer of education Dr. Margaret Gleeson about cuts to programs and staff at Victoria University. Caden, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Greenpeace Oceans campaigner Ali Hooper about the recent UN Oceans Treaty.
He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero. Āno hi pakihere roki roki maoronga i te pai tuku tuku o Erangi Pōho i haere ki 95BFM irakati.com, and catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
For our weekly catch-up with ACT, I spoke to ACT MP Karen Chaw about their proposal to ban contractors from challenging their employment status. Serious allegations of inappropriate behaviour towards children under Oranga Tamariki's care, and ACT's opposition to new standards for surgical waitlists. Here is that interview. If in government, ACT would stop contracted workers from being able to challenge their employment status, why is this important to you?
Yeah, I mean, we need to create certainty for businesses, and people want contracts to be independent, and they want to be able to be their own employees or contractors. The problem is we need to clarify the law to define who is contractor and who is employee. Doesn't really eliminate the risk of it being challenged, so we would just remove the opportunity for that to be challenged. And the reason is it just gives some certainty to businesses that they can put out a contract for a specific task and that person is not going to be classed as an employee.
ACT has said that barring those in contracting arrangements from challenging their employment status, like you said, would give certainty to businesses, but you've also said it would give certainty to employees. Can you explain how this would give certainty to employees in particular?
Well, it just helps that they would be able to get some entitlements. Like, some companies may offer them other entitlements on top of their contract, and it allows them to know that they can accept those extra entitlements without even then the business turning around and treating them like an employee rather than a contractor. So it works both ways. Sometimes a business may offer them a bit of a perk and a bit of extras that is what has enabled them to challenge this, that their Uber contract has enabled them to challenge it because of those extra entitlements. So it works both ways. It allows them to be able to negotiate on their terms. But there have to be specific terms. There have to be a written agreement where it is specified that they're an independent contractor and they will not have access to full employee rights. It'll also make it that they have to have sufficient information and adequate opportunity to seek advice before entering the contract, and that it wouldn't restrict them from performing services for other businesses when they have finished their task with that business. So we'd make sure that everybody is looked after.
Trade unions like Etu have said that this policy would let some employers get away with misusing contracts. Do you believe that this is an issue for workers in Aotearoa?
I think a lot of contractors have been surveyed, and there's around 5% of contractors, and 90% of them say that they're satisfied with the positions and they prefer being, that's the word, self-employed. They employ themselves, and that gives them the flexibility to be able to do what they want in their times and actually accept the jobs that they want to do. So I think as much as employers have some responsibility, employees, when they go into a contract, have the ability to negotiate that. They're self-employed.
So you don't believe that it's an issue here in Aotearoa?
I don't think it's as big of an issue as what's happened, but I think because of what's going through the courts with Uber at the moment, well, we need to make sure that we're keeping up with the issues that are going on.
I also wanted to talk to you about serious allegations of inappropriate behaviour towards children in Oranga Tamariki Care. What would you like to see come from this situation?
Look, this is a very sensitive topic, and I've expressed that I'm very unsatisfied with what's happened. When these things happen, there has to be consequences for it happening. We also need to make sure that we are following basic protocols within these organisations. These are our most vulnerable children, and there will always be perpetrators that will target our most vulnerable children. So they will look for work in places like this. So we need to be extra vigilant when we're coming to our hiring processes, our training processes, and making sure that if people do see something is not right within those organisations, that they're speaking up and they feel comfortable to speak up. Why aren't staff speaking up earlier? Why aren't they saying that they're witnessing things that shouldn't be happening? And that really concerns me, that when they were asked, were these people police vetted, they couldn't answer straight away yes. I mean, they may have been police vetted, we're not sure yet, but the answer should have been yes.
Your members' bill proposes repealing a section of the Oranga Tamariki Act. This act requires Oranga Tamariki's chief executive to recognise and provide a practical commitment to the principles of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Why do you believe that Oranga Tamariki not being a treaty partner would benefit children in state care, or particularly Tamariki Māori?
Hey, look, I'm a person that believes that we should be protecting all of our children equally, no matter what. And a child abused is a child abused. A child in fear is a child in fear, whether they're black, white, brown, Māori, whatever. A child needs to be treated as a child. And unfortunately, this section of the Act, which I'm wanting to be repealed, actually divides our children by race and actually treats our children differently because of their race. I mean, I've been a victim of this myself growing up with the old system, this by Māori for Māori approach, which is good in some circumstances, but it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all. I was actually put back in a home that was not good for me under this by Māori for Māori, and experienced more time in a home where I was not safe than I should have because of that policy. We need to be making sure that the kids' best interests are first and foremost, and then we can look at culture second. And culture is important, and it should be considered, but it shouldn't be the only thing that is considered.
Ethnicity, or you've been focusing on race, has been a focus for ACT, and you've recently come out in opposition to ethnicity being a factor in surgical waitlists, and this is one of the factors that the government has introduced for surgeons to consider when deciding whether to give them priority for surgeries, as well as clinical priority, the time spent on waitlists, geographic location, you know, if they live in a rural area, or deprivation level. So why is ACT focusing on just ethnicity in this case?
Well, ethnicity is something you can't change. Ethnicity is something that you're born with. And we kind of feel that race-based policy is never a good thing. I don't believe that in my household that I should have access to different healthcare just because of my race. I mean, I have a mixed household and I've stood up in Parliament and I've said this. Do we think it's right that, my husband, who's a different culture to me, doesn't have the same access to some healthcare that, may not have the same access to healthcare that I would? We live in the same house, we earn the same money, we raise the same children. There's no difference. Yet my culture will be taken ahead of his.
Do you see any of these other factors that have been identified as being a barrier to receiving healthcare that people also can't control as being an issue?
Yes, definitely. So they can't control that. If you're living in a rural area, it takes a lot longer to get to a hospital, it takes a lot longer to get to places, and that should be taken into consideration. And the other factors are good factors, and if we're getting those right, if Māori are within those factors, they will be getting seen under those other issues anyway. What we have an issue with is when you start making race-based policies, where you start making one race ahead of others in your policies, and that just causes division in a country. We shouldn't be doing anything that is race-based lawmaking. It's not right. We're all New Zealanders and we should all be treated equally.
So a number of public health experts have said that this shift is required to make up for inequalities faced by Māori and Pacific people at stages of the healthcare system, like being referred for surgeries or accessing medical help in the first instance. Do you accept that these barriers exist for Māori and Pacifica people in Aotearoa?
Yeah, we need to be looking at, if this is an issue, we need to be looking at it. And if there are doctors that aren't referring people because they're Māori, something needs to be done about that. That is a separate issue. If people are being treated differently because of their race, and they can prove a doctor is deliberately not referring people because they're Māori, then that's another issue in itself, and those doctors should be held accountable for that behaviour. We need to deal with that. But what I'm saying is we should not be putting people ahead of others based on race.
A number of these public health experts have said that what they are proposing to do to address this would be having this be one of five factors considered when prioritising people for surgery. Why is ACT going against medical experts' advice, and who has ACT gone to for your stance on this issue?
You know what, there's also other doctors on the other side of it saying that this is morally wrong and that they didn't sign up for this and that they signed a Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. So there's doctors on both sides of this issue, and I firmly believe that race-based policy and putting other people ahead of others because of race is wrong.
Can you tell me who the other doctors on the other side that you're talking about are?
I'm talking about the articles that I've read where surgeons have said that they're not happy with this, that they didn't sign up for that, that they signed an oath to do no harm, and that they don't feel that this is right. They don't feel that putting someone ahead on a list based on race is right.
So these are independent surgeons or individuals, not medical organisations and bodies?
You know, when you want something to work within a healthcare system, you have to bring everybody on board. You have to make sure that it's going to work. And when you've got some people working within the medical profession that have spoken out and have spoken against the tide and who have felt like they aren't able to voice themselves and have gone to the media and haven't named themselves through fear, you know that there's an issue and that this is a discussion that needs to be had. And I personally, myself, believe that this is wrong.
And that was ACT MP Karen Chaw.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
For old times' sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
If in government, the ACT Party would stop contracted workers from being able to challenge their employment status. This comes after Uber drivers were deemed employees of the International Ride-Sharing Service in a landmark employment court decision. I spoke to Etu Union spokesperson Annie Newman about ACT's policy. Here is that interview. So as a trade union, why does this policy concern you?
Yes, we look, it's about contract doors, as opposed to workers who are just contracted and therefore employees. In other words, it's about workers who are deemed to be their own employer or their own business. And so this is a tool that is used from time to time to for businesses to distance themselves from the obligations associated with being an employer. And that can lead to a great deal of exploitation because those workers are expected to pay their own ACC. They don't get any sick leave, they don't get any holiday pay, they don't get any of the things that a normal employee would get. And often they're fully controlled by the business. So in the end, they're basically an employee, but they're being treated as though they're a business in their own right.
In what situations would a worker be considered a contractor versus an employee?
Well, there are some people are very happy to be contractors. They might run a design business. They might run a construction company. They might hire out their labour for digital services. So there are genuine contractor situations where people want to be independent. They are independent. They have complete control over their destiny. It's not those ones we're worrying about. It's the ones that are like Uber drivers who've recently won a decision that they're actually employees. We had Ali's G Sky Chef. They provide catering for airlines. They were workers that were deemed to be contractors. A case was taken. It proved that they were not contractors. They were employees. And so those are the kinds of situations where we know that it's a disguise for an employee without any of the benefits associated with that relationship.
An argument that I've seen is that outside of the Uber case, there are no examples of exploitative employment relationships of this nature, but you just listed quite a few. So how common is this happening in Aotearoa?
It's not uncommon. And quite often, we're not alerted to those situations because workers who are deemed to be contractors often are at a distance from a union. But workers, for instance, who deal with communications, there are chorus workers. There are all sorts of workers who might be in situations where they are, to all intents and purposes, under the control of the employer, but are really employees. So there are a lot of them. Now, some of them will be independent contractors. So, you know, you can't say for sure that every worker that you say is an employee or the contractor is in fact that. That's why we need to retain the right to be able to seek recourse to justice, or those workers need to retain that right to have recourse to justice in the event that they don't have the freedoms of a contractor. And this position of the ACT Party is that they would no longer have that access. As long as they signed up to something and said that they were a contractor, that would be it. They are a contractor. Now, we know that that's not how it works in the employment relations environment.
ACT has said that a contractor who believes that the terms and conditions of their contract are unfair has recourse under the Fair Trading Act and the Employment Relations Act. Do you believe that this is enough protection for workers?
No, because people move into these environments without any awareness of the rules and regulations around their employment status. So you can have large numbers of workers, such as a whole catering service, where in fact they're being exploited, and those workers need to be able to have their employment status defined. And so we're going through a process at the moment where there is a law to define it. It's been put on hold because of the Uber case, so there's going to be a period of time before it goes to the Court of Appeal and we find out the final reason. We'll find out what the final decision is. But we believe, and those workers believe, that they were employees, and they should be able to test that. Because employment law in the end is about providing safety for workers who have less power than the businesses that employ them. So how do you create more of a balance in the employment relationship? And part of that has to be access to justice. So we believe that there's an assumption that as long as people sign up to something, they say that that's all right, I'm an employer, I'm a contractor, I'll deal with that, then that's what they are. But, of course, people need work, and they'll often sign the piece of paper that's put in front of them because they need the work.
Actors said that this would give employees as well as businesses greater certainty. How accurate is this statement?
Well, it's completely inaccurate. So the only thing that gives people certainty is when there are boundaries and rules in place. And what ACT and National propose is reducing the barriers, reducing the boundaries, reducing the rules, and that puts workers at the mercy of businesses. And there are many businesses out there, so I'm not suggesting that all businesses are bad, but rules are there to protect people against the poor actions or the poor decision-making by those who have more power. And so the decisions that ACT and National are likely to make if they get into power are going to create a great deal of suffering and a huge imbalance in employment relations. That's not going to be good for anybody, because actually a low-wage economy is bad for everybody. We know that the inequality that exists within a country generates a whole lot of poor outcomes in terms of health, education, safety of our communities, all of those things. So if we want to have a better country, a safer country, a fair country, and one where human rights prevails across all spheres, including employment, then we have to have rules in place. And we cannot back parties that want to see those things dismantled.
Both ACT and the National Party are opposing fair pay agreements and also proposing bringing back 90-day trials. What would this mean for workers?
Well, it just shows that those political parties that sit on the right of the spectrum have no interest in the human rights aspects of employment. The fact is that workers are subject to a whole lot of control by their employers. And that often means that they live in poverty, they work long hours, they don't receive the breaks that they need. All of these things have to be regulated because the market will never deliver justice for workers. So if we want a balance in employment relations where employers and workers have a fair go, that relationship must be regulated. That's a position that both National and ACT oppose. And we need to fight very hard to make sure that families in New Zealand do not suffer under a regime where they are subject to anything that happens out on the market.
That was ITU Union spokesperson Annie Newman discussing contractor rights.
The French, for instance, love the cock. You're tuned into The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beer.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11pm, only on 95BFM.
Brought to life from the page to the stage, from the beloved Enchanted Wood series, Timbrae Theatre Company presents The Magic Faraway Tree.
Don't miss this extraordinary tale from the mind of global bestseller Enid Blyton, as a captivated trio discover magical lands atop an enchanted tree.
Timbrae Theatre Company presents The Magic Faraway Tree, on now till July 15th at the Pump House Theatre, Takapuna.
Tickets and more info from timbrae.org.nz.
Oh, it's your voicemail. I'm at the gig and I was thinking about you. I thought that you'd be here. Guess that you don't check the 95BFM entertainment guide. That's a shame. It's my last night in the city. I'm flying out in the morning, so guess I probably won't see you again.
Oh, there's someone in here.
Don't miss the moment. Check the 95BFM entertainment guide. It's gigs in that. Online at 95BFM.com and on air 7 days a week. Just one of the many reasons Auckland is a UNESCO City of Music.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last week, the United Nations formally adopted the International Oceans Treaty, which was agreed to in March. I spoke to Greenpeace Oceans campaigner Ali Hooper about her experiences during the treaty negotiations and what the next steps for the treaty will look like. I started by asking why the treaty is significant.
So the Global Oceans Treaty, or the BBNJ agreement, is super significant because to date, we don't have a way of managing high seas areas, so those areas that are beyond national jurisdiction, national kind of waters. But, you know, areas that fall in the high seas make up the majority of the ocean on this planet. So what happens in those areas can have a huge impact on the Earth that we live on. So this treaty will give us the ability to not only create protected areas on the high seas, which was not possible before, but it will also allow us to assess the environmental impacts of other industries that are operating outside of those protected areas. So it's a really, really landmark agreement that has been unanimously agreed to at the UN, and it could really create an amazing amount of change for the future of this planet.
What are the impacts of the treaty on Aotearoa?
Well, I think that, you know, New Zealand has one of the largest EEZs in the world, like kind of the area of ocean versus our landmass. We are also an island nation, so like what happens to the ocean is incredibly relevant to New Zealand. If we have healthy oceans, then we can have a healthy planet. So I think we have as big a stake as any other nation in this, but you know, as a country that's deeply connected to the water, I think it's really important that we're on board with the strongest treaty available here.
You were at the UN in March when the treaty was being drafted. What was that experience like?
It was a very interesting, eye-opening experience being in New York for the negotiations. I think, you know, this treaty has been negotiated for years and years and years, and I think it was amazing to see it actually completed. There were plenty of times during the negotiations it felt like we weren't going to get there. Countries still had significant disagreements quite late on in the game about what this treaty should look like. But I mean, my takeaway at the end of it was we spent 36, 37 hours in a kind of mammoth session inside the UN where countries were just trying to like finalize the deal, and the fact that they did and the fact that they were able to put aside their differences and make compromises gave me a lot of hope actually for the future of our planet, but also for the fact that we can work multilaterally in order to create positive change.
And what are the next steps for the treaty?
So what happened last week on the 19th of June, I think, was that the treaty was formally adopted at the UN, so that's really great. So as you know, in March, the treaty text was agreed, then it was translated and legally scrubbed. Now it's been adopted, and now the next stage in the process is that it will open for signing, and we need 60 countries to ratify the treaty through their own national processes in order for the treaty to be brought into force. Organisations like Greenpeace want to see that ratification happen really, really urgently. There's a lot of momentum behind this treaty and behind this campaign to protect the global oceans. We don't want to see that momentum lost. So we will be pushing countries, especially high ambition countries like New Zealand, to ratify the treaty as fast as they possibly can. We're hoping that by early 2025, we can have a usable treaty and we can start actually getting protected areas in the high seas in place.
So what's the process for ratification in Aotearoa? Is it just a matter of putting pressure on the government?
Well, the actual process of ratification, I think, is quite complex. I think the any international treaty has to align with our kind of domestic policies. So they've got to do some work. The government has got to do some work there in aligning those two things. And my understanding is that there will be a team set to work on that, essentially, in order to make it happen. But yes, I guess from the civil society side, from Greenpeace, we've been working on this for years, and we've been, you know, raising public awareness about the importance of this treaty and pushing for it. So we will continue to do that work. We will continue to lobby the government, and we will continue to create that public pressure to ensure that decision makers know that we're not going to forget about this agreement that they've made and the fact that we need to protect the oceans urgently.
And are these protections enough for our oceans?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you've read any scientific report over the last 10 years, what scientists say is that we need to protect at least 30% of the land and sea in order for us to have a habitable planet for the future. In doing that, you protect biodiversity, you can avoid the worst of the climate crisis. And at the moment, we're really not doing a good enough job of protecting areas of the planet that need it. So this treaty is the pathway to getting that in the high seas. Before this, we didn't have a legal mechanism to create protected areas. Now we do. So let's use it. And what we're hoping and what we will be pushing for, obviously, is that the areas that are protected first are the most biodiverse and the most important. So you're talking about things like migratory pathways for whales and turtles, deep sea ecosystems where coral create habitat for all kinds of other marine creatures. So we want to see biodiversity protected. And there's a lot of advice and there's a lot of case studies out there to show what kind of areas should be prioritized for protection first.
And is there anything else people should know about the treaty?
I think all I would say is that the fact that the treaty was agreed is a truly historic moment that can't be overstated, but that we will all need to keep an eye and keep a watch on how this develops and how these protected areas develop, because they're not in place yet. So we've still got some years of work ahead of us, but we know that New Zealanders care about this, and so that we hope that they'll be behind us in pushing for this protection urgently.
That was Greenpeace's Ali Hooper on the UN's Ocean Treaty.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Victoria University has proposed significant cuts to staff and courses, including theatre and secondary education. The university blames underfunding of the tertiary sector, as well as a drop in international and domestic student enrolments. Firstly, I spoke to senior lecturer in education at Victoria University, Dr. Margaret Gleeson, about the secondary education program being cut completely. What was your reaction to this announcement?
Well, real distress, as a matter of fact. It's a program that's been going for about 40 years, and we just couldn't believe that they would take such a drastic measure.
If this goes ahead, what options would current and future students wanting to study secondary education at Victoria have?
Well, there's a couple of options that they could have. One of them that the ministry or the government has been drawing on recently is recruiting teachers from overseas. But we think that is actually a bit of a problem, not that with the teachers themselves. It's just that teachers who are prepared in our initial teacher education programs are also being prepared to be responsible to Te Tiriti partners. And if we recruit teachers from overseas, there's a real danger that they won't understand the cultural landscape that we are trying our best to prepare teachers for. So that's one option. And another one, of course, is that the students or the potential student teachers will go to other New Zealand providers, and I think probably that's what they will do. But even so, there won't be enough secondary teachers to fill the gaps we have in our classrooms. And the other thing that sort of is really of concern is that our particular teacher education programs have been developed in consultation with the sector, around Wellington in particular, and also with local iwi. And so that means that the programs that we have, the secondary education programs, are situated within an educational framework that incorporates evidence-based practices, including Maserong Māori, which they may not get outside our university. And the other thing really is that we're responsible to our local kura partners. I mean, we've been working with local schools for, 35, 40 years, and we have a very strong relationship with them, and they employ our graduates happily and the hot off the press, really. And so I feel that we're going to be letting them down as well. It really is a concern, Jessica.
How will staff like yourself be affected by these cuts?
Well, 5.5 full-time equivalent staff members are going to be cut. So I think that we will be invited to take voluntary redundancy, and those of us who don't wish to take voluntary redundancy might then be pushed, because at present on the table there isn't any option for us to retain parts of the secondary program, or to, you know, to reorganise the way we do things to make it more cost effective. So at present, it looks as though quite a few of us are going to be asked to leave.
Would you be able to give some insight into what the loss of this program and other programs will mean for Victoria and other Aotearoa universities' reputation?
So our Faculty of Education programs were in the top 100 in the Times Index. Sorry, I've forgotten what the word actually is, just a couple of years ago. And so this program has international renown. It's highly, highly respected. And I guess the university, the wider university, isn't as invested in preparing teachers as we are in our particular faculty, which, of course, historically has come from a college of education where our sole business is preparing teachers. And so I don't think the investment in the wider university is there. And our leadership may not understand, you know, how damaging cutting this away is going to be for the wider reputation of the university. Universities, because I'm sure that Victoria is not the only one that's affected in this way.
What will this mean for our secondary education sector as a whole, given we are currently experiencing a teacher shortage?
It's really bad news. The bottom line is, as I said earlier, they are going to, I would imagine, schools are going to have to try and recruit teachers from outside New Zealand, which is, you know, it's just shameful, because we are perfectly capable, more than capable, we're experts in preparing teachers for our own educational environment. And it's, you know, it's a devastating loss for our sector. And particularly in the secondary sector, I would say that because I used to be a secondary teacher. But in the past, secondary teachers were prepared to teach subject matter, and I think internationally this is still probably the case. But what the trend now, the difference that in the programs that we offer now, are that secondary teachers are being prepared to teach ākonga. They're being prepared to teach children or young people their subject matter. So the relationship with the learner is coming first, which is something the primary and early childhood sector has done always, but something that's relatively new in our sector, which you won't be getting from teachers recruited from elsewhere.
I'm sure I'm not alone, and I'm struggling to understand why this course in particular has been cut or is being proposed to be cut, because education is such a crucial sector. So why do you believe that the university has chosen this program?
It's expensive, Jessica. The issue is because secondary teachers are being prepared to teach subject matter in secondary schools, there are subject matter experts who are doing that preparation. And that means that we have a wide number of small courses, which I'm sure that if we had the opportunity, we could work to consolidate. But traditionally, you know, you have had a maths expert preparing secondary maths teachers for part of the program, and an English specialist preparing the English teachers to be. So that has made it expensive staffing-wise. But once again, it's a really valuable job. Sometimes you just can't measure things. You can't measure it in money. It's expensive, but it's a really valuable thing that we're doing, I think. But that's why, Jessica, because it's an expensive program to staff.
Do you believe that we have a chance to save the program at Victoria?
Well, we and our colleagues and our wider networks are working really, really hard. The proper consultation document will come out on Monday afternoon, and there's a series of meetings that we've got set up to look at ways that we can push back on this decision, because we think that it's, you know, it's quite easy to cut a program that's built up over all these years. It's really hard to reinstate it, and there aren't that many secondary programs on offer across the Motu. So we're going to work really hard to try and sway both our leadership and the minister that it's worth saving.
And what would your message to the minister be, or any incoming government, when it comes to addressing the issue of the underfunding of universities?
Well, I have to speak from my own point of view, but that is, it's really short-sighted. You know, we are preparing the youth of tomorrow. We're preparing the politicians of tomorrow, you know, the leaders of tomorrow. And why? Why on earth would you cut away this really influential sector when it's an opportunity for us to shape society into a way that's into something that we as New Zealanders should be proud of?
I also spoke to lecturer in theatre, Dr. James Wenley. Firstly, I asked about how the theatre program will be affected by the cuts.
So the theatre program is being cut by over half. So we've currently got 10 staff positions that would go down to 3 academics and 1 technician. And they're also wanting to fold us into the English program. So that would really drastically reduce what we're actually able to teach. In terms of what we do really well, we're the really good mix of both theory and also lots of practical experience for our students, and they get to really kind of specialise in the different areas that really interest them. So both performing and acting, but also things like design and scenography, things like producing and production management and directing. So I very, very much worry about what a really reduced offering is going to look like with so few staff. We just won't be able to do the things that we do.
And what was your reaction to this announcement?
Well, we know that the university is in deep financial trouble, so we were expecting that, you know, we would have to weather some cuts, but none of us were expecting such a deep and radical change to the theatre program. It effectively is the end of the theatre program as we know it. We've got a 50-year history at the university. Well, one of the things that's actually really distinct about Victoria University, our theatre program is the top one in the country. We're rated in 1% of performing arts programs across the world. We're a really, really key part of both, I guess, Wellington as a creative and cultural capital, but also we feed in to the national performing arts sector, that our graduates are sort of everywhere in terms of both the theatre industry and also beyond, with all the great theatre skills that the degree provides.
Can you tell us why having programs like these are important in Aotearoa?
Well, we need to be telling the stories of here. We know that actually arts and culture is really integral to people's well-being. It's something that allows people to kind of bond, and it brings communities together. There's actually like so much research out there about the benefits, but again and again, it feels like we have to keep fighting these battles to say, actually, this stuff matters and is important. And I think it's really important that we say no to like any further cuts, both in education, but also our arts and culture infrastructure. I mean, thinking about theatre specifically, you know, it really brings life to New Zealand. It tells stories about ourselves. It helps us think about our identity. It contributes kind of so much to our society. And, you know, our theatre students sort of prove that in terms of the amazing work that they go out and do. Like here, the New Zealand Fringe Festival is full of our students making really, really exciting work.
Why do you think that these programs like theatre and other creative and art subjects have been the sort of the first to go in these cuts?
You're right that it always is arts and culture that is first to go. I'm also doing a sort of a research project at the moment in terms of media coverage, and you know, arts and culture kind of gets deprioritised there. So it's all about these kind of bigger narratives about what's important. And when you're kind of thinking about what's important, we should be thinking about health, we should be thinking about education, but also arts and culture is a really essential sort of plank of that in terms of being able to live like a good life. And as I was sort of saying before, in terms of like well-being, there's really, really strong outcomes because things like performance gives us a place of community and has really powerful outcomes. I teach a course at Victoria University called Theatre for Change, and that looks at all the different ways that actually theatre and drama contributes across society. Like, it can be really powerful interventions in terms of the social justice system. It actually is an investment in the long run in terms of like the health system, to actually have kind of arts and theatre and performance in place, because it does provide that well-being outcome for people.
Do you think we have a chance to save this program and other programs facing cuts at Victoria?
Yeah, so we are one of many programs that's facing really steep cuts. I'm really concerned about the end of secondary teaching at Victoria University. That just seems ridiculous when we really need more teachers. Things like the School of Music, we're all in this together. And it very much is going to take action by the government in order to stop this. Because it's not just Victoria University, it's all the universities across the sector are facing really big challenges coming out of the pandemic. There wasn't wage subsidy support. Universities have been really chronically underfunded, and it's all kind of coming home to roost. So the Labor government are responsible for this. They can decide that actually this is really, really important. This is a non-negotiable, and so we do need to step in and give some money. I kind of don't see any other solutions except on that political level and having that political will. I think it's really cool to be talking to 95BFM. I was actually a graduate of the University of Auckland drama program, and they've done really well, but they've also been really small. And so it's a real sort of tragedy when you don't actually have strong performing arts institutions across the country. And I really think everyone should be able to have access and opportunity. And I think there's a real danger of across the country and at the University of Otago too, of all the stuff being lost. So we really, really have to fight the fight and ensure that they continue.
That was lecturer in theatre, Dr. James Wenley, and Senior Lecturer of Education, Dr. Margaret Gleeson, discussing cuts to programs at Victoria University.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. ACT MP Karen Chaw, ETU Union spokesperson Annie Newman, lecturer in theatre Dr. James Winley, and senior lecturer of education Dr. Margaret Gleeson, and Greenpeace's Ali Hooper. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.